This is May 1st, 1990. Howard Braun and Flo Joseph at Dath Ashurin with Rabbi Morris Landis to record oral history for the National Council of Jewish Women. You may recall, Rabbi, we were here a couple of times before, so this will be our third tape. When the ladies at, or I don't really know who they were, at the National Council of Jewish Women reviewed our tapes, they reminded me that, gee, you have a great sense of humor, you tell stories, and everybody knows you for all that, and that while we got the pretty much the straightforward factual items in the background, your education and who brought you to Pittsburgh and why and all the circumstances, and many things, we did not get a lot of other of the kind of things, the kind of accounts which you're very noted for in your both congregational and pastoral work and also in the community. So I thought we'd come back and see if we could provoke you to just general reminiscences about the people and people you've met, scholars you might have known, rabbis you might have known, political personages, why and who and the wherefore. Now, but you did tell us about Teddy Kollek and the kosher issue, and his dinner. I do remember that. And let you go on.
Well, on that vein, did I ever tell you the one about Javits, Senator Javits?
No, not that I remember.
Well, at the 20th anniversary of the State of Israel, Senator Javits and Senator Clark, who was then the senator from Pennsylvania, both asked me to give the invocation at the U.S. Senate on the occasion of the 20th anniversary. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, they had a luncheon in the Senate, I suppose it's the Senate dining room, in honor of the occasion and also in honor of me. It was also the first time that the senators had to get together with Rabin, who was then the coming in as ambassador mm-hmm. from Israel to the United States.
Mm-hmm. What year was it, do you remember?
20 years ago. Today is the 42nd. To cut down 20 from 42, that's 22 years ago.
22 years, yeah.
22, and now it's 90. Mm-hmm. So when was that about?
68.
68, yeah. Something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway. So we were seated there, and there were some people from our congregation there, as well as my mother-in-law, my children, and my wife and I. My wife was sitting up on the dais, the head table, I suppose it wasn't a dais, and the senators were coming in, and Rabin's wife was not there, and they all assumed that she was Rabin's wife, and they all came running over to shake her hand. But in any event, they were having a luncheon, and the same thing happened there as happened with Teddy Kollek. I had asked them to serve me tuna fish, to me and all of the people that came with me from Pittsburgh, to serve them all tuna fish. And Senator Javits, Jacob Javits, incidentally, was seated right next to me. And he said, "But Rabbi, we're serving fish." So I said, "Well, I don't eat cooked fish either." So he called over the waiter and he says, "Serve me tuna fish also." So I said, "Senator, you can eat what you want." He says, "No, I'm eating tuna fish."
I'm glad that there is a bit of an out.
Yeah.
That does work in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. Huh?
Talking about food, we had another one. Who was the representative from our district? I know him well, but the
Moorhead.
Moorhead, that's right. Mm-hmm. Moorhead. It was also an occasion that we were in Washington. to meet with the senators, and we had a luncheon there that the Zionist organization was sponsoring mm-hmm. for the senators and for some of the Zionist mm-hmm. dignitaries. And I was the chairman in that event.
Mm-hmm.
And they served. I don't remember what they served, but it was something I couldn't eat.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked the waiter, "Could you bring me vegetables mm-hmm. instead?" And he brought me cooked vegetables, so I wouldn't eat cooked vegetables either. So I said, "No, I wanted a
raw salad.
So he brought me a raw vegetable salad with shrimp in it. So I couldn't eat it, obviously. And
it gets worse all the time.
Yeah, and Representative Moorhead mm-hmm. came in and he said, "Gee, I was just at a committee meeting, and I didn't get a chance to eat lunch." So I said to him, "Representative Moorhead, do you like shrimp?" He says, "I love it." I said, "Here, be my guest."
Yeah, you were able to be the entertainer there.
Yeah,
yeah, that's good. A lot of food stories and a lot of kosher food stories as we interact with our neighbors and other people. Glad there are those.
I'll tell you something. You know, my wife's grandfather, Rabbi Ashinsky, he uh-huh. was the patriarch of the rabbis here at Pittsburgh. I may have mentioned that he organized.
You told us all about that.
So anyway, so well, in the early days of the state, he was already housebound. He couldn't go out.
Mm-hmm.
And the chief rabbi, Herzog, came into town. And when he came into town, one of the first...
Came where?
Into Pittsburgh.
Into Pittsburgh. Yeah. Herzog was here.
Yeah, into Pittsburgh. And when he came into town, one of the first things he asked for was Rabbi Ashinsky, and they mm-hmm. told him Rabbi Ashinsky couldn't come.
Mm-hmm.
So he had, I think Herman Feinberg was in charge of the mm-hmm. thing at the time, and he said, "Well, I'm going to go to see Rabbi Ashinsky." And they took him, he lived on Darlington Road at mm-hmm. the time, and they drove him out to Rabbi Ashinsky. And as sick as he was, Rabbi Ashinsky, he had his robe on, and he insisted on standing up and greeting the chief. That was the first chief rabbi after the state came into
yes.
being. Uh-huh. He insisted on getting up and meeting with him.
I would think he would. That's a good story. Uh-huh. A very good story. Goren I've met. He goes around that big synagogue there. I'm trying to remember the one in Jerusalem. And Goren walks around the place like he owns it. But I don't know what Herzog might have been like.
Well, Herzog was one of the old school. I mean, more dignified.
More dignified.
Let's say than.
The interesting thing about Goren is that he shakes everybody's hand very democratically.
Uh-huh.
But I can recognize a difference that he goes out of his way to do that.
Well, no, Herzog was in that respect was very similar. Uh-huh. He would meet with everybody and shake their hands mm-hmm. and so forth. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He was Herzog, as you know, was chief rabbi of Ireland before mm-hmm. he came
yes.
to here.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the British Isles made a contribution there. Yeah, that's good. Were you in Israel by any chance during that early period when shortly after the Ben Gurion's announcement, were you there at all?
No, I my first trip to Israel was in 59.
Was in 59. Mm-hmm.
And then I was there. I've been there already 20 times.
Yes, yeah, so I knew that you've been a lot of times since.
So, but I was there right after the Six-Day War. They chose a select number of rabbis
mm-hmm.
To go and see the liberated territories, mm-hmm. Judea and Samaria mm-hmm. and Gaza and so forth. And we went all the way up to the Sinai. We were at the mm-hmm. Suez Canal.
Mm-hmm. Did you get to Hebron on that trip?
On that trip, I don't remember, but I've been in Hebron.
I was just wondering what your perception and reaction are to those tombs.
Well, I think it was at that trip that I did. That trip, I think, was the first time.
Mm-hmm.
I remember now. My sister, who lives in Jerusalem, and another rabbi who was a friend of mine, but he was also a friend of one of my brothers, and therefore he was a friend of my sister's. So we decided to go down. We took a cab from Jerusalem to Hebron,
uh-huh.
and we saw the Rachel's tomb.
On
the way, and we also saw the
patriarchs,
the burial place of the patriarchs.
Do you have any reaction to
that? Well, it was something. It was the first time. It's like the first time I was at the wall.
Uh-huh.
It's first time I came to Israel, you know. But after a while, it's sort of the novelty wears off.
That's right.
In fact, now when we go to Israel, and we go practically once a year, we don't go any place. We just go to visit with my children and grandchildren. They're up north, and that's where we go. We seldom make any side trips.
That's true for all of us who've been repeatedly there. I was affected somewhat differently at the Patriarchs than at the Wall, and was surprised to see the I forget what they're called. You look in through a grating. You remember the bars in front of the wall. And then you look in, you see those cataphracts or whatever. And it had the strangest reaction of thinking, good heavens, could that be them?
Well, I'll tell you, of course, that they have a section where they have the Arabs worshipping.
Yes,
because
of course.
They revere Abraham.
That's why they're there.
Abraham was their ancestor.
Yes. Well, that's the reason they preserved that spot.
That's
but
right.
I was looking for whether you had any reaction like mine.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel's tomb there, too, was... an an oddity. I knew about the others. I didn't know about Rachel's tomb being separated.
Of course, I knew about both of them, and we went specifically to both places.
To both places. On the way, I found them until first. Yes. All right. Any other sites in Israel that you recall especially that had
I'll tell you, the first time that I was there in 59, I was leading the tour for my father-in-law. He was a travel agent, and he had set up...
Ashinsky?
No, my father-in-law. Ashinsky was my grandfather-in-law. My father-in-law was Louis Borkin. He was an editor of the newspaper.
Yes, right.
So he had set up a... trip to Israel as a travel agent, and I was leading the trip. And it was about the time of Lag BaOmer.
Uh-huh.
And Lag BaOmer is dedicated to...
trees.
Now it's dedicated... It's actually a student's holiday.
Mm-hmm.
The students go off and they used to picnic at that time. And also it was devoted to Rabbi Akiva and also to Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai is traditionally buried in right in the mountain outside of Tiberias.
Mm-hmm.
And,
So
and if you went to the and you'd have an influx from all over Israel of people going to either the synagogue in Tiberias, and which is beautiful, to the Cairo synagogue, Joseph Cairo, who edited the Shulchan Aruch, which is the guidebook for traditional Jewry. And also there was the grave of Rav Shimon ben Yochai. And the tour that was set up that we were going to visit Tiberias on the day after Lag BaOmer. But since I was in charge, I told the tour guide, I said to him, what kind of business is this sending us there on the day after Lag BaOmer? If anything, we want to be there on Lag BaOmer. And at that time, it was in 59, they were still gung-ho on tourism in Israel, this was their big thing. So he said, okay, we'll change it. And they came from all over Israel to that. And the place was packed. And they would go from the synagogue in Tiberias and carry the Sefer Torah, the scrolls of the law, from Tiberias to the mountain. And it was so crowded that you couldn't even walk there. I mean, it was, if you've ever been in Times Square on New Year's Eve,
it felt like that.
It was like that. So you could only be at one of the two places. You could either be in Tiberias or you could be at the mountain, but you couldn't be at both places. But since and they take the Torah out and they would take it and dance with it and carry it, but since we were tourists, they made an exception for us and they let us go through from Tiberias to the mountain there. And at that time, the children who had gotten to about 3 years old, they gave them their first haircuts, and they burnt the hair there on the mountain. And people who were sick, you know, crippled, God forbid, or anything else, they would come and they would think that there would be a means of getting healed from that. And it was really one of the most moving experiences that I had. And then we came back. At that time, we were dwelling was in a hotel in Haifa. And we came from Tiberias into Haifa, and we came in the nighttime. And you'd come up to Mount Carmel, and as you'd approach Mount Carmel, the whole area there was ablaze because they built bonfires on Mount Carmel. And it was all ablaze with fire. You'd come there and you'd see all of these bonfires.
Exciting, wasn't it?
It was really an exciting experience, yes.
Mm-hmm. Those are good stories, good Israel stories. And hard sometimes to recall them after 20 trips.
Yes.
But you know, I think, I do, like you and everybody else does, you get jaded and you don't go to the old digs anymore. Mm-hmm. But one or two or three days of a trip.
Well, we try to sometime, but you know, lately, you know, we're not getting younger.
I know, it's a good excuse for all of us. Neither am I. I'm just trying to provoke you.
I'll tell you, when I first came there, for example, Ashdod, which is a flourishing fort there, was desert.
Yes.
They were just beginning to build a couple of apartment buildings there. There may have been about 20, 30 families living in the area, and now it's a metropolis.
Yes.
Beersheba was just a couple of hundred families there, and all they had to eat was really sort of a more or less a makeshift dining hall, whereas Beersheba now is...
This is a substantial city.
That's right.
That's right.
So these are things. I went down to... That first time we went to Eilat, we took a plane and we went to Eilat, and it was just a desert area.
That's right.
It was practically, you couldn't get anything to eat there. Mm-hmm. Well, you did. You could get things
to eat. Well, there was minimum things.
But it was minimal. Yeah, it was very minimal. And, of course, but they already had the glass bottom boat where you could go and see the fish.
Hey, I want to provoke you to something else. In your various trips to Israel, did you meet people like Rabbi Kaplan or Heschel or any of the others who spent substantial time
in
Israel?
Well, no, I didn't meet any of the other people, but I did meet the chief rabbi of Haifa because he had been here, and I met him. And
who? Do you remember?
His first name is Sher Yashuv. Which means the remnant will return. Sher Yashuv, I think his last name is Cohen.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I remember Sher Yashuv.
I
had met him there. First of all, he's a cousin of one of my congregants, and also he had been in Pittsburgh, and I had met him in Pittsburgh, so I met him there. But other than that, I didn't usually go to meet dignitaries. I met them. I mean, I met Ben-Gurion, Oliver Schoen, but I met him as part of a group.
Yes, I'm not looking for that.
When I was in charge of one of the Israel Independence Day celebrations here in Pittsburgh, I had occasion to correspond with Ben-Gurion, and he was already in Stay Boker. I still have his letters he wrote to me in Hebrew, longhand, you know, not typewritten, longhand letters that he wrote to me.
The old-fashioned ones were and the, were Hamish people. Yeah,
He was complaining that state of his health is not what it was.
Yeah, of course not.
Yeah. And at that time we got a tape from him that we played at the celebration.
That Rabbi Landis has some of Ben-Gurion letters.
Yeah.
You have anything from Golda Meir?
No, but we did have, I think she was on the tape too. I think she was prime minister at the time. Mm-hmm. And she was on the tape.
Do you have the tape?
The tape, I don't know where it is. If it's any place, one of two people might have it. It would be either the Zionist organization or it would be Pittsburgh Zionist Council,
mm-hmm.
which now has become Pittsburgh Zionist Federation.
Mm-hmm. So they may have.
They might have it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what happened.
What year was that?
I don't recall anymore. It was a number of years ago, but I don't remember anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been the 25th anniversary. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so 45.
It was
about 1970.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Yeah.
I mean, if
it's okay.
If we had time, I could look back.
No, that's
out.
Okay. Yeah. Those trips were fun, and apparently you still enjoy them.
Yeah.
And all right, let's get back to Pittsburgh. Who are some of the rabbis you've known in Pittsburgh? Who was the guy the one on Shady and Wilkins?
You mean Halpern?
Halpern. Did you know him? Anything?
Well, yeah, I knew him well. I knew all of the rabbis well. I'm still a friend of Dr. Friedhoff, and I was a friend of Halpern. There was a Rabbi Rose in the Beth Sholem. I knew him. And, of course, one of my closest friends was Rabbi Benjamin Lichter across the way. In fact, each time that they'd be looking for a new rabbi, he'd come and say, why don't you come over here?
Uh-huh.
But it never did.
Never did.
Yeah.
What was there about any of them? For example, I picked Halpern just out of the air. He was, noted in many ways. And
well, Halpern was in history. He did some historical studies of Rashi, the commentator on the Talmud and on the Bible. Friedhoff, a Reform rabbi, was in response of Shalas Tshuvas, which was pretty odd for a Reform rabbi.
He has quite a reputation for that, a worldwide reputation.
Yeah. But we would get together,
did you ever talk to him about responsa?
Yeah, well, I was about to say, when we get together, we're supposed to be get together because there's something we had to discuss that should have taken 5-10 minutes, and that's what I had locked out in my appointment book, but I'd never get out of this place less than an hour and a half, because I was one of the few people that he could sit and talk about.
Yeah, well, you have to do the same thing. People ask you shilas of all sorts.
And mainly we'd be talking, Talmud and shilas and shuvas, so forth. So we'd be discussing that. We're supposed to meet for 10, 15 minutes, and it could last for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
That's when he told me that famous story, which I will not repeat.
you son of a gun. I'd love to have that story.
Yeah.
And I even remember the Yiddish punchline. I think it was in Yiddish you told it.
Yeah.
Friedhoff, for example.
Now Lichter was one of the most popular rabbis in Pittsburgh, primarily because of the fact that he was a native Pittsburgher, and he was not married, so he had time to devote himself only to the congregation, and he was called the marrying rabbi because he had so many weddings that he.
Oh, but he didn't himself.
He didn't know. He didn't practice what he preached.
Yeah.
And of course, in the old timers, the Rabbi Ashinsky was really, as I said, one of the real men that helped
build the Pittsburgh community.
Right. And he was known worldwide. That was why Herzog, for example, wanted to see him.
Tell me, what about him? I mean, what was the distinctive
Well, he was noted as he was one of the original Mizrahi rabbis. Don't forget that in the Orthodox group, there were a lot of people who were not Zionists.
Yes, I know.
A lot of them were opposed to. They were not opposed to Israel, but they were opposed to the concept of political Zionism.
Yeah, that's right.
And he was one of the early ones who did espouse political Zionism. Right. So this was something new. This was something novel. For example, Rabbi Maimon was also one of those, and he was a friend of all of these people. He went to the original congresses. He knew Herzog. He knew Theodor Herzl, and so forth. So, this was one of the things.
What would a guy like Rabbi Ashinsky say about a Scheigetz like Herzl? Did he ever, as far as you know, express himself on that point?
I think you understand my question. The only thing that I know is that he really respected her.
He did. That's an interesting point. That's exactly what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
It seems to me that there has to be an explanation why a person like Rabbi Ashinsky, coming from and Herzl, can still substantially communicate. Why can't our present?
Well, some do and some don't. For example, I'm Orthodox and I get along.
You do perfectly. You do perfectly.
But I mean, for example, Ashinsky was a friend of Freihoff.
Mm-hmm.
He was a friend of all of Freihoff's predecessors here in town. So he did get along with the
rabbi.
And his attitude was, as mine is, that even though theologically I might disagree with them, when things that are for the benefit of the community and for the benefit of
the Jewish people,
we would work together.
Yes, I know. And that's so scarce. Scarce sometimes both.
Well, now you know that right now with our yeshiva, Dr. Lamb, the president, and so forth, is one of those who has been espousing the concept that we have to work with all groups.
Yeshiva?
Yeshiva University.
Oh, Yeshiva University. Yeah. Thank you. In fact, they're the only ones. Very good. That's been very powerful.
Important. They have been, and that's a tradition that I was raised
in. I know. They're being excommunicated almost by some nuts. There's always the right wing trying to drive the people who...
You know what they say in economics?
Please.
Bad money drives out good money.
It's called Gresham's Law.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same thing in Judaism, in every place. The extremes drive out the middle. That's true. Yeah, well, let's tell us just about Freihoff a moment. If you talked questions with him... It always was said, you know, that his scholarship was excellent, just his conclusions were wrong.
He was raised in a very Orthodox family.
Yeah.
His father was a shofet in Baltimore, and Baltimore was renowned as sort of the Vilna of America, because in Baltimore, the only time I've been in Baltimore was to change planes from Washington to Pittsburgh. Baltimore, the stores, the Jewish stores, were closed down on Friday night and Saturday.
Yes.
It was really a phenomenon there. And his father would fit into that community.
I understand that. I'm talking about Rabbi Freihoff's ability to appreciate the necessity of halakha, try to apply it to the reform world. I think their belief is that, or some people's belief is that without halakha you can't have Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
How can you have reform halakha? By definition, it doesn't work. Well, nevertheless, you ever had this discussion?
Well, don't forget to say that reform halakha is sort of a strange thing, because no matter what there is, none of his responsa were binding on them.
That's right.
In other words, he could give the most scholarly interpretation and say this is the way it should be, And a two-bit rabbi from a two-bit town could say, I don't need to do that.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, I'm trying to get you to cope with that matter. He did it. People did ask the questions. They were real questions.
Yeah.
They did have a following. People's attitudes are influenced. But in a free world, in where individuals have autonomy, you have the choice that you just described.
Mm-hmm.
His readers said, well, I can't buy that.
Yes.
Okay, I want you to respond to that.
Well, that is the reform point of view, that they're not bound by any authority necessarily.
Okay, what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that?
Yeah.
Because I believe that there should be a basis for, first of all, when you talk in terms of the Orthodox point of view, we believe that the oral law was divinely inspired. And therefore, you cannot go and say that if something came from heaven, that I will dispute what came from heaven. In other words, logically, there's no logic why you shouldn't be able to eat pork. It's just that this is part of the Bible, and we follow that. It's not a case of logic. If you want to, it's not a case of something to vote on. Whereas in the Reform movement, you could, and many do. I'm not.